From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with Mark Matabani. His book, Kaffir Boy, is about growing up in a black township in South Africa. He escaped that life through a tennis scholarship that brought him to America. Also today, I talk with folk singer Hazel Dickens. She sings in the new John Sayles movie, Matewan, about a 1920 coal miner strike in West Virginia. She grew up in West Virginia in a coal mining family. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new compact disc reissue of The Complete Coleman Hawkins, studio sessions the tenor saxophonist recorded in 1944, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews Trying Times, public television's new comedy anthology series. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Matabane. He's written an autobiography about growing up in South Africa, in the black township of Alexandra, near Johannesburg. His family lived in a shack and was so poor they were sometimes reduced to eating weeds that grew near the outhouse, frying locusts, and scavenging for worms. His father was a tribalist who didn't want his son to learn English. His mother wanted him to get an education and sent him to a tribal school. Matabane got high grades in school, but it was tennis that turned out to be his ticket out of South Africa. He was introduced to tennis by the white family that his grandmother worked for. After playing with the Black Tennis Association, he met Stan Smith, a white American professional tennis player who helped get Matabane a tennis scholarship in the United States. Matabane got a degree in economics from Dowling College on Long Island. He now lives in North Carolina, where he's working on another book. South Africa revoked his passport in 1981. Mark Matabane, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Before we talk about your life in America, let's talk about your life growing up in South Africa. Could I ask you to describe the home that you grew up in?
The ghetto where I lived was Alexandra, which was 1 square mile. With over 100,000 people, and many of these people lived in shacks. Our shack was 15 by 15 feet, and we slept on the floor on pieces of cardboard under the kitchen table, and often during bitter winter months, my mother would reinforce the one thin blanket we had with pieces of newspaper. The only twin bed in the house belonged to my father and mother and the latest infant sibling. We did get by with $10 a week that my father made as a menial laborer because he was denied other means of earning a living. But our problems were compounded by just the sheer terror of apartheid.
Well, one of the terrors that you experienced regularly growing up was the terror of the police raids. Mm-hmm. What was the purpose of the raids? What were they looking for when they'd come knocking on the door?
It was very confusing for a child to try and understand the brutality of the police because you expected them to protect you. But when they burst into our home, often after midnight or in the middle of the night, without a warrant, breaking down the doors and smashing windows, and then marching my parents naked out of bed and standing them in the middle of the room and interrogating them, I think that the trauma was so deep that you really felt naked terror. And it turned out that their problem was that they did not have a permit allowing them to live together as husband and wife, which is why they had to escape from their own home every day. And this permit was required in order to limit the number of black people within what is called white South Africa. So without these permits, obviously you could not live as a family. And so the raids were basically designed to tear the families apart.
And to exile whoever they could to the homelands.
Mm-hmm.
So you grew up in absolute fear that, that the police would come on the door and take your parents away, mm-hmm. or brutalize you and your brothers and sisters.
Mm. Yeah, they often took them away, and they would not tell you where they'd jailed them. I remember my father would often be away for months, and when he was away, we really experienced nightmares because he was the only breadwinner. And his being away meant that we had to scavenge for food in garbage dumps, or we had to go to the local abattoir and beg for gallons of cattle blood and come and boil it as soup and drink. Oftentimes we had nothing to eat, so we simply stared at each other and the empty pots and the sun going down. But we were lucky. We remained together. We had some roof over our heads. There were friends of mine, 5, 6, 7 years old, whose family had been torn apart, and they now lived on their own in scrapped cars and abandoned buildings, eating out of trash cans, and they were literally making it on their own.
How old were you when you realized that what you were experiencing had to do with this system of apartheid that white people in South Africa had created?
I think instinctively from the moment that I was born, because just under the conditions under which I was born, many black women in South Africa cannot afford maternity care. So they have to deliver babies under such difficult circumstances that many of them die either at childbirth or in their infancy from preventable diseases. And I survived a few, and I think that was my first encounter with apartheid, because South Africa has one of the best medical institutions in the world. It gave the world Christiaan Barnard in 1967. But it allows black people to just die like flies. So that was my first encounter. And I think as I grew up as a child, being cruelly robbed of my childhood, I never had any childhood, because from the moment I began to realize the brutality of the world around me, the crime, the poverty, the hatred and the anger, I was forced to act and think and feel like an adult. And that's a very heavy toll to exert on the sensibilities of a child.
It must have been very difficult for you when you first started meeting white people. The mm-hmm. first time you'd actually go into an area where there were whites, because as you explained in the book, whites were banned from the black townships without mm-hmm. without a permit to be there. And in that respect, they were almost allowed to remain ignorant of mm-hmm. how bad the conditions really were mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, that trend still continues today. Outsiders in America know more about blacks in South Africa than the average white South African knows of his own fellow people. But yes, I didn't see my first white suburb and meet the first white child till I was about 11 years old. And I remember I was so mortified at the thought of going into the white world, because my view of whites was conditioned by the movies, the violent movies which they fed us in the ghettos. So I envisioned this world full of terrible people, brutes. So when I went and realized that, my gosh, these people live literally in a paradise on earth, because they had paved roads, they had mown lawns, flowers, huge houses. I remember asking my grandmother that who does that house belong? It was like an average suburban house. And she said that it belonged to one family. And then I imagined that that very same house back home was partitioned to house over 100 people. I think I began to see the disparities. And of course, to me, that trip made me feel like I'd made a leap into another galaxy, so to speak.
Mark Marabane is my guest, and he's written an autobiography about growing up in a black township in South Africa, and his book is called Kaffir Boy. Grew up speaking a tribal language, and your father, the way you explained it in a book, mm-hmm. wanted you to only speak that, and he didn't mm-hmm. really want you to learn English, whereas your mother mm-hmm. really hoped that education would help you get out of mm-hmm. the kind of conditions you'd grown up in. Can you tell us a little bit about what the school was like that you went to, the tribal mm-hmm. school?
Yes, it was like a chamber of horrors, but the horrors began before I enrolled in school, when my mother would get up at 3 a.m. for 6 months and go to the police station to ask for that piece of paper without which I could not enroll at this tribal school. Well, I finally got there, but there was no money for the primers, which cost about 20 cents, and for the uniform, because black education is inferior and not compulsory. And so we had to do some deciding. you use 20 cents to buy me a prime and we starve for a day, or we eat for a day, and I don't have the book. Well, my father felt that it had to be the latter. We had to eat, and school, he didn't care about it. But my mother insisted that I go to school, and she would take a penny here and a penny there and buy me the books. And of course, she would be involved in huge fights with my father, because as he was being emasculated by the system and his sense of humanity twisted, he began to turn against people he loved the most. And he became such an alcoholic, he gambled, and he abused his own family. So he fought my mother every step of the way when she said, "He must be educated." He said, "No, this is my son, he won't be." And my mother was an illiterate. She never went to school, yet she had this incredible vision to somehow believe that an education could make a difference for me. And she sacrificed so much. I mean, she was suffering under triple oppression as a black, as an illiterate, and as a woman. But even with her own battles, she found time to say to me that, especially when the going got rough, when I came back home whipped black and blue, crying and say, "What's the use of all this?" You know, she would always say that, you know, "Child, always have hope. Things will get better. You know, always believe in yourself, that this is a good thing. You will see it eventually."
This reminds me of something that you mentioned in your autobiography, that you'd go to school, and although you really enjoyed learning and were very excited by books, you'd sometimes say to yourself, "What's this education for? What am I going to be allowed to do with it?"
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that that questioning was reinforced by what I saw happening around me. Educated black people ended up picking up garbage cans, and they really almost did nothing. And obviously the reason was that this education, which was in many ways indoctrination to make us better slaves, was really breeding within us some of these attitudes that apartheid wanted us to have.
You ended up learning tennis, which ended up being your mm-hmm. ticket out of South Africa. You were introduced to it through the white family that your grandmother worked for.
Mm-hmm.
What interested you in tennis when you first found out about the sport?
I guess it was from boredom that I became interested in tennis. I had played soccer. I had been involved in street gangs. I had seen many of my friends killed. And when I made that visit to the white suburb and saw these people play this rather dainty game, I said, "Well, let me take it up as a challenge." And I got my first warped tennis racket and took it back to the ghetto and began pounding against the brick wall. And before I knew it, I heard of an American named Arthur Ashe. And just following his exploits in the tennis world made him the first true positive role model I'd ever had. And I think my understanding of him was that maybe he had become this good in tennis he had become this free as a black man and confident of himself through tennis. So I associated tennis with freedom. And of course, I read of his life, and I knew that he had grown up in the South during the heydays of Jim Crow, and that he had so many obstacles to overcome, the most important which were, you know, just dealing with his own hatred and bitterness and anger, and that he had transcended all these and emerged very proud of himself and successful as a human being. I said, maybe if I, you know, he presented a challenge to me and I wanted to do the same.
There were some interesting conflicts that were posed for you when you started to play tennis. You played mm-hmm. with the Black Tennis Association in South mm-hmm. Africa, and they boycotted matches that whites mm-hmm. participated in.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some of those matches that you wanted to play in because mm-hmm. it was the way that you could kind of get out, really.
Mm-hmm.
But you ended up being banned by the Black Tennis Association for mm-hmm. participating in matches that whites played in.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to go against the Black Tennis Association and play in those matches?
Mm, yeah, good question. I think that fundamental to my decision to follow that rather very awkward and often deadly route was that I had come a long way from the days when I was consumed with anger and hatred and didn't know what to do with them. And having met, through Tennis, some of the few whites who exist in South Africa who were prepared to accept me as a human being and as an equal, I felt that to pretend that they don't exist would be to deny something very fundamental in myself. And so I decided that even though the pressure is enormous to dissociate from these people, that for my own sense of self and for my own continued resiliency as a human being, I just had to make sure that I was very faithful to these friendships. And that is why I often found myself at loggerheads with the more angry and justifiably angry, because they had never had the opportunities to meet these few individuals, but I had, and I knew that I could never go back to the days when I felt that there was absolutely no good white person on this earth.
It must have been a very difficult decision to make, because mm-hmm. on the one hand, you could have stood with the Black Tennis Association mm-hmm. in solidarity for the larger issues, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, you stood a better chance in bettering your life mm-hmm. by continuing to play tennis, even mm-hmm. in white matches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see, I was very young. All these momentous decisions had to be made while I was 15 years old.
That is very
young. And yet I somehow believed that if I survived this nightmare, if tennis took me somewhere, and I desperately wanted it to take me to a place where I could have some freedom to feel and understand what it meant to be a human being, that I would be able to take upon me a much more important duty, which is to tell the world exactly what is going on in South Africa, how the system leads brother to fight against brother and sister to fight against sister by putting them in the same awkward situation that you just described. And I think that in a way, I was lucky to have made it here and to have written a book like that and explaining the same incident that you just mentioned.
Are you reconciled with the Black Tennis Association now?
Oh, certainly I am. In fact, I think in many ways they're very happy that I came over here, because I've been able to get people to recognize the enormous talent that is in the ghetto and the determination of these young Black boys and girls to succeed despite the odds. And I think that the world knowing of the Black children of Alexandra has led to the world responding. And I think that that's a positive thing.
I'd like to talk about your life since you've come to America, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Mark Matabane, who's written an autobiography about growing up in a Black township in South Africa. The book is called Kaffir Boy. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Mark Matabane is my guest, author of the bestseller Kaffir Boy. When you decided to accept a scholarship, a tennis scholarship in America, was it difficult to think about leaving your family behind in South Africa? It's a funny thing. I think it's a typical bond for a lot of families who send their first person, the mm-hmm. first person in the family goes to school, and through mm-hmm. the education, they leave the family, mm-hmm. and the family never knows if they'll return or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was so difficult that I often didn't want to think about it, because I knew that I was not leaving them in a safe place, that I had become a breadwinner in a way because I had a job, and that if I left, they would tumble back into the same pit of suffering and poverty where I thought I'd pull them out of. But I knew I had to leave. I knew that I had to go to a land where at least I could have some freedom to think, to act, and to feel just like a human being ought to feel and think and act. So I left, and my mother, as always, was the one to encourage me to do that. She said, this hasn't all happened for nothing. There is a reason why you have to go to America. But what you should remember is that wherever you go, always believe in yourself. Never allow other people to define your own sense of humanity. And I think I came with those values. And she said the third thing, that you only fail if you stop trying. So those three maxims remained with me when I left. And of course, I had, like every other foreigner, thought America to be a utopia. And when I came here, I realized that there was indeed freedom. There was indeed opportunity. You know, but that alongside these wonderful things were, there was an American tragedy. There was a hideous nightmare which afflicted people of color, people of a different sex, and that these people were subjected to the same degradation and humiliation and hopelessness and hatred and anger that I thought I had left in South Africa. Now, it was very frightening finding yourself alone in a land which you had thought was paradise, and then you see that alongside this paradise there is a sort of apartheid existing.
I'm trying to imagine what it was like for you when you first came to America, which is, of course, a difficult thing for me to imagine. But I'd guess that a very difficult thing for you to figure out was how to relate to white people in America, since the image you had of white people was in South Africa, and most but not all of the white people there were upholders of the apartheid system. Was it difficult to get a grasp of how to size up white Americans?
No, not really. And I think that the reason has to do with the first white American I ever met, Stan Smith, because he represented so much of what is good in America.
This is the tennis pro who helped you get the scholarship
exactly.
to come to America.
There we met just out of the blues, and yet he had the confidence and the broad-mindedness to just accept me for what I was. Now, all the South Africans I'd known, whites, even my best friends, never had that that openness that he did. And that was very important, because even when I came to America and found out that there were the same bigots, the same mental attitudes among some whites that I thought I'd left in South Africa, there was always that hope that there are more people like Stan Smith. Yeah. And but I wasn't quite prepared for some of the devastation that I encountered in the black ghettos of this country, like Harlem, like the south side of Chicago, and many other places. Because there I saw, you know, American children, you know, suffering the same, you know, traumas that apartheid children suffered. You know, having the same anger and hatred and bitterness bred in them. And what was frightening was that it seemed that the whole society was oblivious to this.
What happened to tennis? It was tennis that got you the scholarship to America. Did you continue with it once you came?
Yes, I continued with it, but I just realized 2 years into my degree that maybe it was meant to be a passport to freedom, but not my end in life. Because I then realized that, first of all, education here was not prescribed by the government, that you could read any book you wanted, that you not only could you read, but you could write what you felt and thought. So to me, that was much more provocative. And I felt that at least I ought to try to begin expressing what I so deeply felt, my convictions and my beliefs. And one of them is this undying faith in an education.
A kind of strange twist to your story that many of our listeners might already know about and might have witnessed part of is that Oprah Winfrey, the television talk show host, managed to bring your brothers and sisters and your parents to America to visit with you and filmed the reunion and had the rest of your family on her show with you and with her. That must have been such a very kind of shocking situation for your family to have a television host fly them over to America.
Yeah, it was. We had been separated almost 9 years, and there were some of my siblings that were mere toddlers when I left. But when they came to America, I think they captured the essence of America, the freedom, the opportunity that pervades the air. especially to somebody who's been sweltering under the heat of oppression. And my mother summed it up by saying that she thought she had arrived in Canaan. She's very religious. And I think that they immediately realized the big difference between South Africa and America, which is embodied in the fact that here at least you have certain ideals which you strive after, and that usually what disappoints, you know, America is that there is a lack of collective will to get better, to progress, whereas in South Africa we have nothing to look forward to. The whole law, the whole constitution, the ideals we subscribe to are those of segregation today, segregation forever.
Your brothers and sisters stayed in America, the way I understand it, and your parents, because of, passport issues, had to go back to South Africa?
Yes, we had left other people behind who could not get their papers on time to accompany the whole family. But two of my sisters, the youngest, got to stay, and my brother, because I insisted, rather explained to them the importance of getting an education, and that probably they would have the best education because they were so determined to learn in America. And fortunately, that worked out, and they're in public school.
What would you like to do? Do you want to stay in America or return to South Africa?
Well, I guess that there is so... For me, I can't say this people in general, but there is so much freedom for me that I feel that for the time being, given what I've chosen to do as my duty and as my career writing, that I would like to remain here, because at least I can tell the world about South Africa, about the human tragedy that is taking place there.
Your book is a bestseller. Are you able to send money to your parents in South Africa?
Yeah, even before it was a bestseller, I scrounged around to send them some money to not only have something to eat, but to also ensure that my siblings stayed in school.
One last question. I know when you left, the government was initially reluctant to give you a passport out. And they said, you're just going to come to America and you're going to criticize apartheid. Mm-hmm. And you said, no, you really wanted to study tennis. But after you were here for a while, you did really start speaking out against apartheid. We only have a few seconds. Were you afraid to do that initially, afraid that there'd be some kind of reprisals against you or your family?
Yes, I was, just for a moment. And then I decided to do it. And there were reprisals. Two of my brothers-in-laws were murdered by the police because of my activism. But I just knew that there was just a greater issue here, that my freedom and my safety were important, but not all important. The freedom and the safety of the whole nation of South Africa was of uppermost importance.
And your passport is revoked, which means you couldn't go back now.
Yes, but that's a small price to pay, really, for the freedom and opportunity that I've had.
I regret we don't have more time to talk. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Mark Marabane has been my guest, and he's written an autobiography about growing up in a black township in South Africa. The autobiography is called Kaffir Boy, and it's published by New American Library. Marabane now lives in the United States. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actor Elliot Gould. You'll remember him from his films MASH, The Long Goodbye, and Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Hazel Dickens talks about growing up in a West Virginia coal mining family and leaving home to start a new life as a folk singer. She performs in the new John Sayles film, Mate One, about a 1920 West Virginia coal miner strike. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the complete Coleman Hawkins, a compact disc reissue of some of the tenor saxophonist's 1944 recording sessions. And television critic David Bianculli previews Trying Times, the new comedy series on public television. Each week, a different story with a different writer, director, and cast. The talents assembled include Jonathan Demme, Alan Arkin, Spalding Gray, and Terry Garr. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. The late jazz musician Coleman Hawkins has been called the first great tenor saxophonist. In 1947, he recorded the first unaccompanied saxophone solo. Hawkins died in 1969, nearly 50 years after his first recordings with Fletcher Henderson's orchestra. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new set of compact disc reissues featuring Hawkins.
During the year 1944, tenor saxophonist Coleman Hawkins was in and out of recording studios some 20 times, both as a leader and a hired gun. Nine of those sessions, almost 4 hours of music, were recorded for the Keynote label, and all of those are preserved in full on a set of four compact discs, the complete Coleman Hawkins. It's part of a Keynote CD series on Mercury, broken down from last year's 20-LP Keystone box. Over the course of 61 cuts, Hawkins plays suave ballads and trim small band swing with peers like pianist Teddy Wilson and trumpeters Buck Clayton and Roy Eldridge. He leads a seven-piece group that includes a saxophone quartet and guests on a George Wetling Dixieland date where Jack Teagarden plays trombone and croons an old Maurice Chevalier hit like a cowboy. The books say that Hawkins pretty much invented tenor saxophone, draping elegant melodies over any chord progression, and that Lester Young revolutionized the tenor with messier lines that swung like mad. That's true as far as it goes, but the way it's put makes Hawkins sound like a reactionary whose style had become fussy or dated. That's far from true. During the mid-40s, the New York scene was in transition. Swing was on the way out, bop was coming in, and the old New Orleans style was coming back. While some musicians felt obliged to choose up sides, Hawkins reveled in the diversity. In 1944, he touched on every style yet invented and some yet to come. The find of Hawkins' Keynote set is the first take of Father Cooperates by drummer Cozy Cole's All-Stars. The daffy riff by trombonist Trummy Young thinly disguises Gershwin's I Got Rhythm. But the way they play it must have sounded downright avant-garde in 1944. Earl Hines' knockabout piano and Teddy Walter's jittery guitar might have upstaged Hawkins if the tenor saxophonist hadn't worked out some great scooping phrases for himself. Father Cooperates, take one. Thank you. drummer Cozy Cole with Joe Thomas on trumpet, Billy Taylor on bass, and Coleman Hawkins on tenor sax. Cole's All-Stars went on to cut three more versions of Father Cooperates that day, all included in the keynote set, and all noticeably more tame than that one. The last version came out on 78, and that wacko first take languished in the can, forgotten until the keynote recordings began turning up again. By 1944, Coleman Hawkins and Earl Hines had been recording for over 20 years. Though still shy of 40, they were becoming old-timers in a quickly evolving music. Having heard it all, they could embody a whole history of jazz in one solo, glimpsing the future as they built on the past. So if you're wondering why jazz fans don't mind wading through four-hour sets like this one, full of multiple takes of the same tunes, well, one reason is music rejected as incoherent when it was new may sound clairvoyant now.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat Cadence and Jazz Times. He reviewed the complete Coleman Hawkins on Mercury Compact Discs. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is folk singer Hazel Dickens. She can be seen and heard in the new John Sayles film, Matewan. The film is set in Matewan, West Virginia in 1920, and it's based on a coal miner's strike in the early days of the Union. The film was shot not far from the coal town where Hazel Dickens grew up. In the film, she sings the kind of songs she sings in real life.
You can tell them in the country, tell them in the town. The miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillow. Another ton or lift another finger till the Union we have won. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. There's fire in our hearts and fire in our soul, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole.
Hazel Dickens has built her career singing about the struggles of the poor, women, coal miners, and other workers. When she was 16, she left her large family and headed north.
I didn't intentionally reject that part of my life. Since some of the mines had started to close down around there, there was not a lot of work, which meant there was even less work for women, you know, because women usually did, if there was a factory or a waitress work. If you were lucky, you got office work, but I didn't have that much education.
Were all the men in your family mine workers?
Almost all of them. My father had a truck, and he hauled timber for the mines. And I guess the larger part of my brothers became coal miners, and all of my brother-in-laws were coal miners.
Were they in unions?
Oh, yes. You know, everybody was in unions. And they were very, very strong staunch supporters of the unions, and everybody was a Democrat. And almost everyone was a Baptist.
Did you grow up feeling lucky that you were a girl and that meant that you wouldn't ever have to go into the mines?
No, I sort of grew up kind of resenting that I wasn't a boy because they always seemed to get a lot of breaks that we didn't, and we were very... All of us were sheltered, both the men and women in the family, but I think the girls were sheltered a lot more.
What kind of music did you grow up listening to in the house?
Hardcore country. I mean, very primitive stuff, because that's what my father was a very dominant person, and that's the kind he liked, and he didn't want us to listen to anything else.
So when did you start getting exposed to other music?
Probably not until I left home and came to the city. And it was quite a while, I guess, that I began listening to the radio in the city. And they were then playing, like Top 40. And I began listening to more country western that was updated, and actually ended up singing country western some in my beginning club, you know, and bar appearances around Baltimore.
Did you sing when you were growing up, when you were still in West Virginia?
Yes, I did, but it was usually just around the house. And occasionally, after church, when being a preacher's daughter, the preachers always got invited to somebody's house for a chicken dinner. Invariably, they would start talking scriptures, and somebody would get out the songbook, and they would sing. And I can remember many times his saying how good his daughter could sing and asked me to stand up and sing. And that was the most, you know, most embarrassing and hardest thing for me to do. I mean, it was even, I think, harder than me getting on the stage later and singing.
How did you start to perform? You were so shy about singing.
I think it was because I did it with my brothers and with a friend or two. And I think if it had not been for that, I probably would never have done it on my own.
When you started to sing, was it at local bars?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you have to learn how to handle yourself at those bars? It can get rough.
Yeah, I would just run in the restroom and hide.
Did you ever have any trouble with the male customers?
Yeah, actually as much by some of the musicians as I did the male customers. You know, being chased around the back room by fiddle players and all that. But I was, even though I was very small, I was probably maybe 100 and weighed about 105 or 10. I could hold my own really well. I was very quick-tempered and a real smart aleck. Although I was shy, I still would defend myself.
Physically or verbally?
Both.
Right.
I mean, if they came too close, I mean, I wasn't above hitting somebody if they needed it.
You eventually started singing songs that updated the musical tradition that you were part of, and some of those songs were songs that you wrote, like Don't Put Her Down, You Helped Put Her There, mm-hmm. and Working Girl Blues. Were the traditional songs not expressing what you wanted to say?
Well, many of them did not. They just weren't songs written for women, and not that, you know, a lot of the traditional songs women can sing. And I love singing the traditional songs. I've always tried to show a lot of respect for the tradition from which I came and to help keep it alive. But they did seem to be, you know, at least a large space there that women like me and other women that were coming along could fill. And that was to give other women that didn't want to sing all the old traditional songs, give them something that they could identify with and something that they wanted to, you know, could sing. I mean, I've had many women tell me that, you know, in later years that I was like the only woman that came along that was writing songs that they could sing in the, you know, within the tradition.
You grew up with 10 or 11 brothers and sisters. And to my knowledge, you don't have any children yourself. Is that right?
That's right.
Would it be too personal for me to ask why you've made that decision?
I could just see where that, coming from the kind of background that I did, that it would be difficult for me. And it would be difficult for me to be on the road to do the things that I'm doing and leave a child or children behind. And I wouldn't be able to do that because I'm real old-fashioned in that kind of way. I would never be able to do it as easily as some women do. And also probably seeing a lot of broken marriages in my own family, I was always leery of it. So that was mainly it, I think.
Hazel, I'd like to quote a line from a song that you wrote that's on the new album. It's called It's Hard to Tell the Singer from the Song.
Mm-hmm.
And the line is, she's a hurting woman who lives the songs she sings. She learned them all the hard way on the streets of life, alone. Are you writing that about yourself?
Some of it, I guess, is about me. I was thinking about me and thinking about like a scene in Coal Miner's Daughter when Loretta Lynn was like talking to the audience, you know, where she'd been out on the road so long, she just had lost, you know, she'd lost so much, she'd lost her family practically, and she was talking to the audience. She said, I can talk to you. I know you'll understand. And that kind of thing, you know, where so many people, and particularly women I was thinking of, that had been through so many relationships where they just lost bits and pieces of themselves all along the way. And they will hopefully take something good along with them and hopefully go on to something stronger. But a lot of people are never able to make those transitions. They end up having a lot in their profession. And I know Loretta Lynn has talked a lot about this and has a lot of wealth. They have a lot of recognition and they have a lot of things like that in their lives. But invariably and very often, they do not have a very close love relationship. And that is what most of us long for most.
Hazel Dickens, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life.
Thank you.
Hazel Dickens sings in the John Sayles film Mate One, and she has a new record on Rounder called It's Hard to Tell the Singer from the Song.
Oh, she is not an angel, so don't look for her wings. She's a hurting woman who lives the song she sings. Well, she learned them all the hard way on the streets of life alone. That is why it's hard to tell the singer from the song.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Well, George Bush made it official today. He announced his candidacy.
He did. We'll have a report, also a talk with Linda Wertheimer, our political correspondent, about Mr. Bush, the vice president. Also, we'll hear about Jorge Valls, a Cuban emigre poet, wrote much of his poetry in prison, and a talk with Bob Woodward of years ago, Woodward and Bernstein. Fame. More recently, the author of Veil, The Secret Wars of the CIA, talks about former CIA director, the late William Casey, and others who figure in his new book.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A new 6-week comedy anthology series is about to begin on public television. It's called Trying Times. Our television critic David Bianculli has this review.
Even the executives at PBS admit that comedy isn't exactly the strong suit of public television. Its head programmer refers to PBS as the humor-impaired network, and it's true. Take away the imported British sitcoms and the occasional American Playhouse comedy, and what have you got? Fond, dim memories of the Great American Dream Machine, which was on PBS way back when Richard Nixon was in the White House. That's why Trying Times is such a big step for public television. It's the network's attempt to do comedy for adults, intelligent, quirky comedies with offbeat actors and no laugh tracks. One connecting theme in Trying Times is that each episode focuses on a person in the midst of a small but tension-filled situation. In the opener, A Family Tree, Rosanna Arquette visits her future in-laws. In another installment, Terry Garr takes a driver's test. In another, Stephen Wright goes on his first job interview, and so on. Another common thread in Trying Times is that the main characters often explain themselves and their actions to the viewer. They talk in quiet voices in front of a cool gray backdrop, like the witnesses in the movie Reds. So is Trying Times funny? Sometimes. Here's Terry Garr in Drive, She Said, trying to bluff her way out of a car showroom.
Well, what sort of thing were you looking for?
Well, I'm a professional race car driver, so I'm looking for a professional race car.
Where do you race?
Indianapolis 500, Wimbledon, the usual.
And here's Stephen Wright in Get a Job, trying to understand why his lack of ambition is a liability rather than an asset.
You mean I didn't get the job?
Look, you're an intelligent, capable person, but I cannot, in good conscience, hire someone who is so stubbornly opposed to self-advancement.
You mean if you like the mailroom, you want to work in the mailroom, and you want to stay in the mailroom, then you can't get a job in the mailroom? Great system.
The six installments of Trying Times are written and directed by some innovative artists. Jonathan Demme directed A Family Tree, Spalding Gray co-wrote and stars in Bedtime Story, and Christopher Durang wrote The Visit. These people don't do television very often, and probably don't watch television very often, so they probably think that what they're doing is terribly clever and sophisticated and unusual. Well, I've seen the episode starring Terry Garr, Rosanna Arquette, and Stephen Wright, and of those three, only Get a Job, starring Wright, is really that clever. And there's nothing that unusual, except for one bloody scene in A Family Tree, where a garbage disposal gets turned on by mistake while somebody's fishing around for a diamond ring.
He'll never get it out with just his hands. Needs to use more ingenuity.
Wait, I think I can almost feel it down here. Wait, I think I can almost see it.
Oh, good.
Cut the light on for me.
Sure.
The happy truth is that network sitcoms grew up between the time this PBS series was proposed years ago and the time it was finally produced. Now there are intelligent, quirky comedies with no laugh tracks in primetime on all three networks. Frank's Place, Hooperman, The Slap Maxwell Story, and The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. With Trying Times, PBS has added some good humor to the mix, but not in time to patent the recipe. Trying Times is worth trying, and PBS executives have every reason to be proud. They do not, however, have any reason to gloat. From what I've seen, Trying Times is good. Frank's Place and Molly Dodd are better.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with K.D. Lang, the Canadian country and blues singer. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile Smiley Lewis, the late New Orleans pianist and singer. And book critic John Leonard will review Bluebeard, the new novel by Kurt Vonnegut, the author of Slaughterhouse-Five, Cat's Cradle, and Breakfast of Champions. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.